Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because today we have with us John McLaughlin. John is a managing partner at Emberline, as well as the CEO of TBX. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Christian. Happy to be here.
Super excited to have you on. Why don't we start with Emberline? We'd love to know the firm's investment thesis.
Sure. So we're an investment fund, and unlike the other ones that are empire builders, we really focus on thematic opportunities. So what does that mean? That means we look for big ideas where we can invest our capital and expertise to do something, you know, magical, if you will.
And so, you know, before the podcast, we had a chance to talk, and you had mentioned to me that you have experience with private equity. I'd love to know how that's carried over today and how you guys think about cutting checks.
Right. So I started my career actually in Wall Street trading. So I was a equity derivative sales trader, which is an interesting place to learn about risk and opportunity. And I left that because there were some problems with investing in options, if you will. You're sort of waiting for the world to do something, waiting for management to do things. And I wanted to figure out, well, what's happening in the companies? What's going on at the company level? So I actually, before I went, became a private equity operator, I spent a year backpacking around the world. And that really like changed my perspective on things. So when I came back, I actually wanted to work at a startup, but I couldn't get a job at any of the companies in Silicon Valley because I came from finance. So I had to take a different approach. And I ended up getting my MBA, which was a crash course in everything that a business does. So operations, sales, and marketing, and then finance that makes the wheels turn. Sure. I always thought of it as a triangle. And I got lucky. I still try to get a job in venture-backed world, but again, they don't actually hire MBAs either. So I don't know what I was thinking when I thought I'll get an MBA to get a job in Silicon Valley. I got lucky. I met a CEO who took me under his wing, and we went to turn around for private equity companies and government services. So the first one was a company called Pan Am World Services, and that was essentially Pan Am's government services arm. I don't know if you know this, but Pan Am had an airline. It had a hotel chain called, well, Juan Trip had a hotel chain called Intercontinental. And then the third branch was a logistics and government services arm. So the company got its start building Cape Canaveral. So people used to ask me, hey, what do you guys know space? And I would say, oh yeah, we built Cape Canaveral. And I'd kind of leave it at that, but we didn't do high-tech things. It was more roads and commodes. So it was facilities management and maintenance, like catering service, logistics, air traffic control. We did engineering services, IT, system integration. It did all sorts of things. It was a really good opportunity for me to learn how many different businesses work, and what it really opened my eyes around niche markets, I would say, is the key theme there. That CEO, he took me with him to another aerospace and defense company called Ericsson, where we had two different private equity owners, and it was a manufacturer of helicopters and an operator of helicopters. Think of it as if Boeing had an airline, right? Yeah. You know, so got to learn about how to produce aircraft and support aircraft, and then how do you manage a fleet? Yeah. A really good, that company, by the way, is like the Goldman Sachs of aerial firefighting. It operates in 33 countries around the world, deep in aerial firefighting, power line construction, and timber harvesting. Again, great opportunity to sort of learn how to add value, work with teams in a turnaround situation. So you're coming in and things aren't perfect, right? And what someone told me, which I believe too, is turnarounds are a lot like growth, and people don't realize this. And it's like you're making lots of decisions, things are changing very fast, and you have to, and you're trying to rebuild the company. It's different than growth, where you sort of have a clean slate. Turnaround, I feel, is a little bit sprinkling of you know, some of the challenges of team dynamics, of, you know, older management teams lying to them and so forth. So learned a ton at Ericsson, and really was at the, you know, going to the board meetings with the owners and sort of thinking, hey, is this the top of the ivory tower? And we had some big ideas for that company that really never materialized. So for me, it was a moment in time where I figured it was time to step out. And that's where I found a business partner with a similar philosophy and viewpoint. And we started Emberline. We raised money, and really around the first thematic view was the world is going to burn down. How do we put together the right technologies to mitigate risk? And at the time, what we saw was the world was set up around sort of legacy incumbents and sort of legacy mindset. And we really found some opportunities to invest in culture and team and technology. So profit and impact, all of that together, and stepped out, raised some money around that. And we bought a company called Intera in 21. And Intera is a leader in integrating data and technology to monitor and mitigate risk, not only fire risk, but also all hazards, I would say. Okay. So that was 21.
And then I'm referring you to when you say bought, but 100% ownership, or are you guys doing, are you creating like an SPV where you're bringing in other investors?
Yeah. So we create we're a hybrid. We have a fund structure, right, with limited partners in it. The found in every situation is different. Sometimes we talk to business owners that want to sell 100%. Sometimes we talk to business owners that need resources and a team to sort of get to where they want to go. And Intera was the latter. We had a strong management team, a strong vision, and they needed resources to sort of execute on that big, hairy, audacious goal, right? The world's burning down. We have all this technology. Why isn't being implemented in the field, right? It was kind of the core idea. And we brought, new thinking, capital, and a strategy to sort of get out there, pound the pavement, sort of link this up. So that was Intera. The other companies that we acquire were 100% cash out, which is a little bit different. Usually in that situation, the founder wants to retire, or it's time. You know, it's I think they said somewhere, it's been said that on your deathbed, no one has said that they wish they had spent more time at the office, right? So sometimes it's a little of that. Sometimes it's health issues, right? And sometimes it's legacy of the company. How do you pass the baton to a new steward and owner that sort of believes what you believe? And I think it's been an interesting journey for us in that we've sat down with owners and tried to really pick that apart, try to learn how can we can be a good partner to them. And I think that's one of the things that makes us different is a lot of folks are out there just trying to buy stuff, right? Everybody's getting emails every day, like, we want to buy your company. It's sort of the, everyone's just trying to, you know, throw the lure out there and catch a fish.
Sure.
For us, we're a little bit more methodical in our approach as to, we don't want to just, you know, buy random business. We really want to buy something that we can grow and protect and do amazing things with.
That's awesome. I have to ask, the year-long backpacking trip, was there a specific event or catalyst that kind of triggered you and set you down this path?
So I worked with a guy who did something similar, and he kind of took off, and he went gone to India and like spent 6 months out there and was like, you should do it. And I said to myself, you know, I grew up in Costa Rica, so I have a little bit of international flavor to me. You know, it's just sort of down the road, but it's something I always thought would be interesting. I never traveled. I was just working all the time, right? Working for different banks and working in finance. And I was, you know, if you took 2 weeks in finance, you'd come back and someone would say, hey, 2 weeks must be nice. You know, well, we're back here, you know, working our tails off. And that culture still, unfortunately, permeates in Wall Street. So I figured out, if I had to take the chance, I would take it at some point. And it was something that was itching. So I bought the ticket one way. And I was like, okay, I bought the ticket to Nepal, to Nepal. And I was like, okay, I bought it. I'm going to do it. I resigned from my job, which was really difficult for me. You're kind of like walking away from your career, everybody that you know. And everybody honestly probably thinks you're an idiot for doing something like that, because in New York City or the big city, it's like, you know, you are your resume for a lot of people. So
my answer,
it was a macro risk advisors, MRA. We're We're a sales trading shop, boutique advisory firm for, and I think RIA now, but we're trading 10% of the VIX options on any given day. You know, we supported all the who's who, over 100, you know, massive hedge funds, and a really awesome place to learn about options. Sure. But after 4 years of staring at Bloomberg, you're sort of like, hey, let me go. I've been writing about gold and writing about Asia and all these places and sort of a macro perspective. Why don't we go down to the ground level and sort of explore them? So I sold all my possessions, unwound my apartments, and just took off. And it took 90 days. I was living in a coconut hut in Goa. And I was sort of like, okay, actually, I don't really care what the S&P is doing today. I don't really care what, you know, VIX is at. And sort of, it took about 3 months, I would say. And I met a lot of up and comers on the trip, sort of young people trying to figure out what to do with their life. And I had an opportunity to sort of, you know, tell them like, you can do whatever you want. Like, don't be beholden to societies or your parents or other people's expectations. Like, you can really do anything. You just need to have a little bit of courage. So, yeah. And there are a lot of people out there like kind of finding themselves out there on the road, right? In Burma and in Nepal and India and Philippines and Indonesia. It's a big world. So when I came back though, I was interviewing when I was in business school, I was interviewing and they bring in all these Fortune 50 companies to hire, you know, to load up the boat with young, you know, debt laden MBAs. And I remember an interview with a guy from Dow, and the guy said, "Hey, it looks like you have a big gap on your resume." And I gave him the spiel, like, "I have all this newfound perspective. I'm back. I'm like ready to go. You know, blah 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 blah." And he didn't buy it. He sort of was like, "So it's going to be quite an adjustment for you." And I told him, "No, it's not. I'm ready to start working." And he said, "No, this is going to be quite an adjustment." And I said, "No, it's not." And then he said again, "Yes, it is," letting me know that that was the end of the conversation and the interview, sort of like, you're not the right material to work at Dow. And so it was sort of a bumpy road coming back. So I think a lot of people realize that. And what I hear is people say, "Oh, I can only take a month off," or "I can only take 2 months off, because if you come back, people aren't going to hire you." But I think you can get a job. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think, you know, there people are looking for folks with different backgrounds. And you know, I'm happy I did it. And I think back fondly to my time out there, if you will, out there in the world.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think I heard you use the word courage. And my perspective is it takes a tremendous amount of courage to be able to walk away from a position that's arguably very coveted. Right? I mean, how many people would love an analyst job on Wall Street to then sell everything and head out on the other side of the globe, where I presume there was no infrastructure support network, just you and yourself. So, yeah, I mean, I think most people can't do that. So good on you. Okay, so you pick up this phenomenal experience, and now you find your way to Emberline, and really unique. So you have two different, you start to form your portfolio. In Terror, there's ownership. TVX, you guys, sounds like 100%. You own the company now. How do you think about creating a foundation and growing these businesses, knowing that your control over them is different with each company?
Yeah, great question. It really depends on the dynamics going into it. Even before the dynamics, it's sort of, we look at it. When I was an equity derivative sales trader, it was all about having ideas. It was about coming up with an idea and then executing on the idea, where you could buy a bond, you could buy equity, you could trade currencies. Like, what do you do? That's the world of macro. It really helps you think about trade-offs. And then going into buying private companies, it's similar but different. And I would say it's the four or five things that we think about before we buy anything is, number one is the trend. You definitely want to get in something that the market's growing, or like you have tailwinds, the winds at your back. Wildfire is a great example of that. The world's getting hotter. It doesn't matter. I don't care who you talk to. The data shows world's getting hotter and drier. And that means there's going to be more fires. It's very clear correlation. So sure. We want to get long a trend. And the aviation one, it was about safety and compliance. The world has older aircraft that are getting older and flying with new technology put in it, and A&Ps with less experience. That's a a recipe for needing technology to help simplify the world, right? So another trend, right? Number two, we look for good companies to express that view or that trend. You can buy, like, if you had a whole world of 50 companies, which one do you pick? So we spend a lot of time kind of doing rifle focus versus spray and pray. Most people yep. would just say blast them all. We kind of want to buy the best in class or the, you know, a top contender in that to sort of move the market in the right direction. And the we can get into that later, but it's like, you know, what's a good company look like? We look for good companies. Number yep. three is we need a strategy to execute that vision. For Wildfire, it was connecting technologies to monitor and mitigate risk. For aviation, it was like giving everybody one end-to-end tool to manage maintenance for aircraft and safety. So we like, you know, we're very strategically minded. So we say we're a thematic investor, right? We're investing in a theme and a strategy. The fourth I would say is opportunity to add value. So that's where we come in, value creation. They call them value creation plans. Some people call them VCPs. But it's like, okay, we have a strategy. How do we execute it? That's great. We have this big idea. Now what? So part of what we do is we help either bring in the experts, bring in the capital, and sort of make that a reality. You know, it's talk is cheap. You know, action is louder than words. So we'll even go into it. I think I told you earlier. I'm even going in some time. We're even going in and rolling up our sleeves and taking active roles in the companies as needed to execute on these themes or these ideas. And then the last is the most important dynamic, which is who is the seller on the other side? And whether they roll or cash out 100%, we learn the hard way, you know, of like dealing with a non-trustworthy seller. We were in a deal last year that fell apart because we were trying to do a deal that had all those four ingredients, but not the fifth, which was having someone who's trustworthy on the other side of the table. Really, when you're selling your company, you're selling it for the one time in your life, right? You've been working there, building it for 30 years, like put yourself in the founder hat. Then you have to sell it. Why would you sell it to some random person who blasted you an email? That's like almost Nigerian scam level of like, oh, let me just respond to this, you know, person. They say they're going to make all my dreams come true, right? And it's sort of odd that someone would do that, but they do that. And I think for us, it takes two sides. What we learned in our deal that fell apart was a really good learning experience. It was an experience where you learn that it takes two to tango. You really have to have the other side want it as bad as you, because you sort of trust each other. And you trust each other to get not only the deal done, but to transition the company after the deal closes. It's not like the founder sells and then they're like, it's over. It's a transition that happens. And a lot of investors view the transition as one of the biggest risks in any deal, where it's the handoff. So
right.
You really need like a willing seller and a good seller that believes in the people in the company, because they know it's not over. They're sort of not just throwing you the keys, because there are situations we hear about where the seller sells the business, throws the keys, and you can't reach them on the day after signing. They're like, hey, I can't get a hold of, you know, Joe. Joe's MIA. Joe went to, you know, Bahamas. And that does happen. But for us, you know, the deal blew up at the last minute in the blow up one. And it was really a seller that we should never have gotten in bed with. We should never have dealt with. So we spend a lot more time now thinking about that. And if they roll, it's like, you're going to be working with this team together. So it is a marriage. And in any marriage, like, you wouldn't marry someone on the first date, right? You sort of need to take your time to figure that out. So what we advise companies and founders that are selling is, you should definitely meet us, but if we're not the right fit for you, that's okay. It's just like dating. It's sort of, you know, what are you looking for? And some people are looking for different things, and we can help guide them. So I do spend most of my time when I talk to founders, educating them on the process of selling their business. And if it ends up feeling like a good partnership, it doesn't matter if they sell 100% or if they roll in, because even the ones that sold 100% in the other business, I'm still in touch with them. I'm still engaging them, because they got 30 years on me on that business. Like, I should, you know, there are things where maybe I don't know. I'll give them a call and be like, hey, what do you think about this? This is what's happening, because they have so much experience. So they really still, they want to be consulted. They just don't want to do the, you know, 100% full-time founder hat anymore, because they get the headspace back and they can sleep at night again. And, you know, that's no amount of money can sort of compensate for that.
Yeah. No longer staring at the proverbial Bloomberg. I get it. That's brilliant. Let me ask. So I love the conviction on the thesis. Recognizing that the higher incidence of fire, aviation, and a whole host of avenues are a great way to resolve it. But given your option background, do you ever take any steps to actively hedge your positions? I know that I would normally ask that of everyone, but given you were doing it for 4 years, I'd love to know if that's creeped into how you think about investing in these companies.
Yeah, I would say the biggest driver isn't sort of mitigate. It is about risk mitigation. So yes, correct, hedging it out. But we don't hedge it out, or I don't think of hedging it out like I would like buying a put. I think of it as something like a task or a process. Okay. So I spend a lot of time thinking about what could go wrong, right? And that's where the insurance side, where it's like I can't exactly buy a contract if a CEO wants to leave, for example. What happens? Or you lose a key hire. But I'm always thinking, what happens if I lose a key hire, for example, or a key person? So that's one where you're always running scenarios in your head. What do you do? And similarly, being a pilot also teaches you that, because you're always trying to figure out, if I lost my engine right now, where would I land? And you're always playing this game in your head. So those two things, the sort of like what happens is really have a plan B and a plan C and a plan D. Because if you think about them, you're just doing this contingency planning. This contingency planning is the same thing that you really think about with options land. Is like, is that with options land, you're thinking, is that risk priced correctly? Is it cheap or expensive? And kind of like, putting it together. In this situation, you could even say it's like being a debt investor, where it's like the debt investors always think about what could go wrong, and the equity investors think about what could go right. That's how some people kind of, split hairs there in the world of investing. But we are always like contingency planning, and it could be losing a key contract. It's like, what do you do? You get hacked. What do you do? And some of these, by the way, there's a solution. Oh, get hacked? Let's upgrade. Let's look at our insurance policy for cyber, and let's see who our provider is on third party to make sure that we're not going to get hacked, right? So there's a process that you can do, and you can mitigate that risk. So rather than buy an option, it's more like, what are the activities to basically do essentially what an option would do? So we're always at least me, I'm always running those in my head.
I love constantly. That's great. The contingency plan, I think, is a great way to characterize it. I bet a lot of people in the audience can also see how that's really beneficial in managing your downside. I don't think we've touched on it, but haven't explicitly asked. Intera and TBX, what are the companies focused on? What problems are they solving in the market?
So Intera is one of the leaders in integrating technology and services to monitor and mitigate fire risk, but also help public safety have one common operational picture. So if you're in a city, a big city, you'll have all sorts of computer-aided dispatch, record management services, pre-planning, you'll have analytics and reporting. All of these things are distributed and fragmented to different companies. And as you move around the counties within a city might have a bunch of counties touching it. Every single county might be on something different. And the nature of events right now in the US is they don't know boundaries. So if you're responding to an event, you might go to a neighboring county and then figure out that you can't talk to or see what they're doing because they're on some other system. Intera is the sort of glue layer that sits on top of all this to make sure everyone can access the information to make the right decision at the right time. It's how we think about it. So whether it's an oil spill off San Diego or in Las Vegas, they did the pre-planning for the Electric Daisy Carnival, where it's a big event, electronic music event. Some people having a little too much fun. What are the steps that you take to sort of to monitor that risk and mitigate it? So it can be anything. It can be like that level or wildfire. It's a classic example of a large disaster, or a hurricane. Wildfire, hurricane hit. How do you coordinate everybody and communicate everyone, and that they're singing from the same sheet of music? The problem that we also see is that not everyone has the most up to date report or the up to date data, or they know it's out there but they can't access it. So yeah. Intera, again, serves as that integration layer where you just have to log into Intera. You can just get what you need.
I would imagine, too, given we live in a world of finite resources, to be able to get that collaboration and coordination absolutely can make a difference in saving people's lives and property.
Yeah, so it's huge. It's huge, and you'd be surprised. I'd love to tell you that we're like a nice to have, but we are still stuck in many areas in the 1970s where people don't have access to this stuff, even though it's there. So part of our job is at Intera is to really spread the message, and we have a majority of Western states on the platform. We do it all for the California Office of Emergency Services. We do it for the feds, for the federal government, for the U.S. Forest Service. So whether you're federal, state, city, or county, this is like a layer cake of data dissemination and coordination.
Fantastic.
TBX is the new name for combining two businesses. We combine T-Data and we combine the AD Toolbox in one business. And that's a unique challenge. And we thought, hey, should we have two brands or one brand was the first question. And we really wanted all our value and our efforts to accrue to one brand was the first thing that came out of that exercise. We said we didn't need a reference customer or a reference competitor because there are already other competitors out there. So we wanted to be the best of the pack or best of breed. So we combined them. We rebranded because they called an AD Toolbox, they called it AD TBX, and T-Data had the T. So we said, well, why don't we just call it TBX, which is short for toolbox. And we did that. I took the job as CEO to sort of help with that integration to make sure the foundations of the business were coming together in the right ways, right? That the marketing and the messaging was correct, and that the team building the culture, right, is really important. So how do we build the right foundation for growth? Because someone told me the other day, you can't run a marathon. Don't try running a marathon if your shoelaces aren't tied, right? So we got to make sure like the basics are in place. So we're doing that now. It's been enlightening, that one, more than so than Intera, because I'm actually running it. So I get to, I guess follow my own advice, if you will, or do what we practice, what we preach. And I can appreciate the sort of heads. I would say the biggest eye opener for me was just the amount of headspace that gets owned by running a business. When I was running because there was a staggered close, I ran one for 2 months before we bought the second one. I was like, oh, this is nice. I'm like, this is fun. I'm like, I have, one company. Buying the second one really overloaded a ton of stuff on my headspace, where suddenly you're running two businesses, and we ran them separately for all of 2024. Now they're combined as one. But I really appreciate now from sort of the headspace aspect, what founders have to go through, or CEO owners of businesses, just the mental headspace is insane how much they have to handle. So that was the biggest sort of aha. And then the second one, the biggest surprise was things that you think, or you tell your friends, like, oh, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna add like a health insurance policy for people, or hey, I'm gonna pay this bill or add money to this account, could actually turn into 6 weeks projects. Where from the outer from like the layperson that you're telling, you're like, oh yeah, that's easy, that takes a day, but there are situations that have happened being like CEO where things that should take a day take 6 weeks. And other CEOs and founders, I think, appreciate that. You see another one, you go, oh, let me tell you about this thing that took 6 weeks, and they go, oh yeah, I know the type, I know that sort of animal, I hate that, chore. So that's been another one that's come to light. But it's been great. We have a good team, great opportunity, and I would say the last thing that's really good for us is just being embedded in with that customer interaction. I spent a lot of time. I did every job in the company. And I think I told someone else, you can't run a McDonald's if you don't know what every station's doing. So you kind of got to work the stations, right? So we did that. And then the second piece is, what does the market want? What are they asking for? Because we have a I was we had an offsite last week with our development and product teams, and I was telling them about this idea called Choose Your Steve. And it was this, and your venture listeners might like this, where in the venture world we have this process called customer discovery, and they're trying to figure out, find product market fit, and if you can't find it, you pivot, right? It's all based on this Steve Blank view of the world, where you're getting customer feedback quick and the customer's like telling you all this stuff. In the Steve Jobs world, he's very much like, oh, if I asked the customer what he wanted, he would have told me he wanted a faster horse, right? The Henry Ford quote. So you have this, I have a natural sort of design or view or vision, and I'm going to execute that. And then the market's going to be like, that's what I want, right? And that's very much a design first or product first kind of Steve Jobs world. And I think what we are, where we're unique is that you can merge those two. You don't have to choose one or the other. It's kind of a false dichotomy. So for us, it's, we're listening to what the customers need and we're interpreting it in our own sort of product philosophy to give to the market. And you can't do that unless you find your customers that we call raging fans. It's the ones that are just like really love your product, want you to succeed, and sort of give you the three or four things that they want to see. And we have dozens of them. And having the opportunity to meet them and hear them and then have them on the phone where I can call them anytime when we're doing stuff is really, I think, going to make an impact in our product development roadmap. So I don't think we could have done that had I not been in there. So all of that together is to say it's getting easier now that it's becoming one company. But for a while there, it was it was sort of a strange world running two businesses at once.
Yeah, and no doubt, I think it's great too to hear that vision and feedback are not mutually exclusive. I don't know that anyone's ever said that on that way on the podcast before. So great to hear that you're having success with it. Would love to know which, you know, as founder led sales has been a topic on the podcast before. You know, would love to hear how you think about driving top line in your role as CEO.
It's an awesome question. And I think they say, and like one of the big questions for SaaS businesses or venture backed businesses, when do you hire your first CRO and or your first sales guy? And I'll tell you, everybody goes through different sort of curves, bumps ahead, if you will, with this, because they tend to hire a CRO prematurely because they're like, I don't do sales. And the reality is, if you're a very small company, if you're a CEO listening to this, you're the top sales guy. You got to get out there and close deals, and everyone's expecting you to do that. And you can't really understand the value prop or the customer journey if you're not doing that. So in the beginning, the CEO is the top person. Then when it comes time to do your first hire, it's really a trick question too. You don't hire one, you hire two. You need to hire two AEs. Because or call it you know, junior salespeople or just salespeople with a little bit of experience, because those two will if you have one, they get too cozy. Two, they'll compete against each other to find out what the best tactics are, to find and you have a higher chance of hitting this, which is how do you do your go to market? And those two will compete and figure it out for you. Once you find your go to market, you hire the person to execute and architect and build that out for you. That's when you hire CRO. So there's sort of a little bit of a phased approach there. My role going in here has really been to, that's early stage. Later stage, like us, when we come in and acquire a business and grow it, it's really trying to validate. Number one is validate what we thought before the deal closed. Do we still believe what we believe? So I have a list of beliefs and I'm out there trying to test those things. I'm trying to test that people are overpaying for software. I'm trying to test that people don't have software. I'm trying to test that this would be valuable to them. I'm trying to test that, you know, how big is the market? Well, we do those estimates of how many potential customers are there, or a SAM or a TAM. I'm doing all that validation. That's number one. Number two, I am taking calls and I am selling product. And I do that just again to go back in the mindset of I'm trying to understand the customer journey and I want to be on the phone to try everything to make sure I know why someone might not buy or why they buy. For TBX, we're in a very fortunate position because 50% of the people who trial, we have a trial to pay, over 50% who trial it, buy it. So we have a very high trial to pay conversion. So the whole game for us is how do we get more people on a trial? And it's been more of a marketing exercise, I guess. Once you learn a little bit about that and what the needs are, customer needs, and how we market it correctly, or how we message it in the appropriate way. It's been more of a learning for me around marketing. I'm really learning a lot about how to do a multi-pronged marketing approach, right? We're doing a rebrand, and that's where I've been spending most of my time. And but as CEO, there's no job too small. I think there's a lot of people who would say, hey, I don't do that. I'm the CEO. And I think that's just crass. I think as CEOs, we got to lead by example. And what I presented to my team at our first offsite a couple months ago was we showed an org chart of sort of a functional org chart of all the positions in a company, right? And sort of how that works. And then rather than have the first one had the CEO on top and sort of your functional areas below it, right? Like any org chart. But then we took the CEO and the CTO and we put them on the bottom and said, this is how we really think about it. You guys are leading and we're pushing from behind. It's really that Toyota mentality, which is, how can I help you do your job better? What do you want to be doing? How can I empower you? What's on your mind? Like, how can I help you? And it's asking that internally more than externally. You know, in the beginning, you're asking customers, how can I help you? And then you kind of switch to an internal mindset where we're really just asking my team every day, like, how can I get unblock something for you? What's the challenge I can help you with? Like, call me, tell me, raise your hands. And that really fosters the communication and trust that I think we're really trying to see come to fruition here, because it's early days and culture takes time. Anybody who tells you that culture takes less than a year hasn't ever been in a company. they're making that up. So that's been interesting, sort of that shift in mindset and sort of external, internal, from a, you know, selling top line and then moving to other roles within the company.
No, that's great. You know, especially as you get momentum too, you know, enabling your staff, I think, you know, you give them the vision of where you want to go, but then allow them to be creative works really well. You know, and I've had similar experience, especially on the sales side too. You know, yes, founders in the audience, make note, you know, by virtue of the work that we do within Finstrat, we've seen both sides of the coin. Founders will go out and hire a VP of sales or a CRO and, you know, think that they can delegate their entire pipeline to them, not realizing that's not their role. Their role is a closer to manage the AEs. Mm-hmm. And so couldn't agree more. I think it's a brilliant approach, and there's a formula. And I think it really closely resembles what you described. Artificial intelligence, hot topic these days, for good reason. Would love to know how you think about the technology and to the extent that you're incorporating it in any of the companies, if at all, yet.
We're actually thinking we're deep in it. We have not only like advisors in AI, but we've been making our own. You know, we've been trying them out and seeing how hard it is. I made a blackjack game in 2 minutes to. it looked like a real casino and everything. It's pretty surprising. The potential to augment a team. From our perspective at Emberline, we see huge opportunity here. Huge. And it's really around what may look like a boring old fashioned business with deep penetration. How do you layer AI over it to really change what it does? And we think of that as like, what's the big idea hiding in plain sight? So you take like an old boring business with hundreds, if not thousands, of customers, and suddenly those customers are getting a little bit more than what they used to get. They're getting something with AI embedded in it. And I think from an investment standpoint, that's huge for us. And we've been exploring a few new themes and strategies here where we can really reinvent a company. We call them revamping, where it's Marvel. Marvel's not the best example, but it's the best sort of metaphor. Marvel was a bankrupt comic book company. And then someone came around and said, oh, these are all IP. These are all superheroes we can make movies on. And then overnight, it becomes a $4 billion business that's sold to Disney, right? There are companies out there that look like old school 1950s or like old fat, no technology or limited technology. And they could be a technology company, but we just don't see it, right? Or like the person walking by is like, oh, that's not a tech company. I think one of the interesting things about our job is there an opportunity to invest in companies that look boring and then make them tech companies? And that's very different. I don't think a lot of people are saying that. They're mostly sort of saying, oh, I can, you know, get rid of a whole department with AI, or they're looking at it from the cost cutting perspective.
Sure.
Or augmenting. Oh, I can have like, you know, agents support my team and what they do, right? My salespeople now can have automated lists of who to call and sort of enrichment around that data, right? I get all that. But for us, the most exciting piece for AI is really transformative. It's really flipping a company on its head and being like, and Taser's a good example. We think about this one a lot. Taser was a $250 million market cap company that sold tasing guns to law enforcement. Today, it is an AI company. They bought, you know, they launched the camera, which was, you know, Axon, and they have evidence.com, and it's an end-to-end ecosystem of capturing data for law enforcement. All they started out with was a customer list and people they sold tasers to. Think about that. So what's the taser out there that we can overlay technology around, inclusive of AI, that makes turns a small company into a $10 billion company? So I think that's what gets us the most excited, at least me. So that's something we think about.
I think it's a brilliant insight, especially given, you know, you talk to entrepreneurs and they think they have to start from AI from scratch, not realizing that, no, you may actually be better off starting with professional services, hardware, an existing business, and then asking, you know, hey, how do I leverage this existing cash flow to do things better? And the irony of it is your odds of success are probably higher. Even though it's not as glamorous of coming up with the next incredible LLM that the market's clamoring for. John, this has been an awesome podcast. One of the questions that I love to wrap up with is if you had an opportunity to go back and talk to your younger self, what would you share?
That's a great question. I would say don't be caught by paradigms too late. You know, start sooner. I think making those breaks and sort of thinking for yourself could have happened much earlier versus sort of trying to fit in and trying to follow the pack. I think it's never too early or never too late for that matter to reinvent yourself.
I think that's great. I don't know who it was. I think maybe it went over the weekend, but I read someone say something to the effect of we should reframe how we think about, this question we get asked when we're younger about who do you want to be when you grow up versus how do you want to spend your time
mm-hmm.
when you get older. And I think to your point, I think, you know, you just said it in so many words. And I think that's brilliant insight. John,
awesome.
If any of our listeners want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
I'm easy to get a hold of on LinkedIn, or you can look up John McLaughlin or John, J-O-N, no H, at Emberline.com, or on the aviation side, J-O-N at Airworthy.com. Airworthy.com, we got lucky. It's the new domain that we bought for our aviation businesses, and we bought it from a guy who was in film, and I reached out to him out of the blue. I said, hey, if you're going to hang up your hat, it was, you know, he's a film producer. And he owned Airworthy.com, and he said, make me an offer. So we struck a deal, and that's how we got Airworthy.com, which is what we do. We make, you know, aircraft airworthy. So J-O-N at Airworthy.com.
Very cool. Good stuff. Awesome. Well, this is another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. John McLaughlin, Managing Partner of Emberline Ventures and CEO of TBX. Thank you again for being on the podcast.
Thanks, Christian.
I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinTrat Management. Thank you for joining us. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.